Stand by. While NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome to Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione. We are delighted this morning to have a special guest with us, fresh off of an oral argument in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Welcome to Administrative Static, Andrew Pincus.
Thanks. Great to be with you all.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And because we have such a compressed time here, Andy, I'm going to dispense with introductions and just say that you are at the Mayor Brown Law Firm in Washington, D.C., and one of the preeminent appellate litigators in the United States, and leave it at that. Folks can go to the website and check out your CV if they want to do that. Tell us about the case that you had yesterday. This was about the rent stabilization law in New York City. Is that correct?
Yes, we've mounted on behalf of the two major groups of New York property owners. A takings challenge to the New York rent stabilization law, which is a law that's been in effect for about 50 years, that imposes quite draconian limits, not just on rent levels. I think when people hear rent stabilization, they think, oh, this is a law that regulates rent levels. But it not only regulates rent levels, but also the uses of the property.
Okay. Now? Why is the lawsuit being brought in 2021, now the argument in 2022.
We filed in 2019 in the district court. We've been working our way through the system. There have been challenges to this law before that have been rejected. Really, two reasons. I think, and probably your listeners know this. For many years, property rights were sort of neglected by the Supreme Court and by the federal courts. They had a disfavored status under Section 1983 lawsuits, and the law of takings really wasn't very well developed. But in recent years, the Supreme Court has relooked at those issues and is taking another look at takings jurisprudence. So that's one reason. And the other reason is that in 2019, the New York legislature amended the law to make it even more draconian than it was. And so we thought the time was ripe. We were going to challenge it even before those 2019 amendments, but they made our challenge even stronger.
Do you want to say a little bit about the specifics of the 2019 amendments? Is there one thing that jumps out in terms of how much more egregious they made it?
Well, a couple of things they did is they foreclosed the property owner's ability to take back apartments for her own family's use, except in circumstances that almost never can be met and limited to one apartment. Many of these owners are families, individual families, who would like to be able to live together, or perhaps they have an aging relative that they'd like to live with them. The law made that impossible. The law cut out the abilities to get out from under rent stabilization when rent levels reached high levels and the property owner had a very high income level, which the law previously allowed, and it imposed quite draconian limits on the ability to recover the cost of capital improvements, which, you know, from the property owner's perspective, gives them the choice of letting their property deteriorate, which no one wants to do, or investing money that they can't recover. But even before that, the law was quite draconian in basically saying, once you have rented an apartment, your ability to change the use of that unit or that building to some other use, commercial, to demolish it and build a new building, almost impossible to do. And that's something that continues under the current law.
Now, I remember in NCLA filed an amicus brief in this case, so we've been watching it a little bit closely. But one of the things that I recall was that this law was supposed to lapse if vacancy rates got to reach a certain percentage, and it seemed like maybe the law had been set up so that the percentage would never really be reached. And then the pandemic happened, and suddenly it looked like, they might actually have the vacancy rate hit, and maybe the rent stabilization law wouldn't be in effect anymore. And so then they started changing some things around to ensure that the emergency would continue sort of unabated, even though the law said something else about rent stabilization. Is that part of this lawsuit?
That's exactly right. The law has a trigger of a 5% or lower vacancy rate and other factors that the New York City Council is supposed to consider. But the law also allows the City Council to have stabilization in effect for particular areas of the city or particular rental levels, types of apartments. But not surprisingly, for 50 years, every 3 years like clockwork, the emergency has been renewed on a citywide basis. And when it looked like COVID might lead to an above 5% vacancy rate, there were efforts to postpone the survey that's the basis for determining the vacancy rate so it wouldn't be done during COVID for fear that it wouldn't hit the 5% threshold.
Ah, okay. That survey piece was the piece I was missing. So tell me about the oral argument yesterday. How did it go? What were the first of all, who was your panel? I remember Judge Cabranes was on the panel. Who else was on the panel, and what were they interested in probing?
So it was Judge Carney, Judge Parker, and Judge Calabresi.
Okay, sorry.
And, you know, we were originally allocated about 40 minutes or so. The panel ended up being generous with time, and we ended up about double that. They had a lot of questions. The focus of most of the argument was our physical takings claim. As I'm sure your listeners know, the Supreme Court last term issued a landmark decision on physical takings in the Cedar Point case, which rejected the arguments that lower courts had adopted, that the only way you have a physical taking is if there's a permanent occupation of property. And the Supreme Court rejected that and said basically any interference with the owner's right to exclude constitutes a physical taking with some very narrow exceptions. And so we thought that case gave us quite a lift in addition to some other earlier Supreme Court precedents. And so most of the panel discussion was about physical takings and our physical taking claim.
Is there also a regulatory takings claim in the case?
Yes, we have a physical takings claim, and then we have two types of regulatory takings claim. One is based on a dissent authored by Justice Scalia in a case called Pinnell that Justice O'Connor also joined. You know, if you go back to the roots of the takings clause, the theory is the government effects a taking when it imposes on a property owner or a set of property owners burdens that, in all fairness, should be borne by the populace as a whole. And in the Pinnell case, which was also a rent regulation case, Justice Scalia said there has to be a tie between the burden imposed on the property owners and the consequences of the use being made of the property. The evil being remedied by the burden has to result from the use. And so he said, I understand that there can be regulation of excessive rent levels, typical price control regulation allowing only recovery of reasonable costs and a reasonable profit on invested capital. But the formula in that case also required consideration of affordability, whether required prices to be set considering the level that what low and middle income people could afford. And he said that imposes on the owners of the buildings a burden that is results from the actions of society at large. As he said, why the grocers who are charging for food and the clothing stores that are charging for clothing have as much to do with affordability as property owners, why should they be singled out? So we make that claim here because the New York statute requires consideration of tenant affordability. And actually, if you look at the last 20 years, New York City's own index of owner costs has increased at twice the rate that rent increases have been allowed largely because of this affordability consideration.
But we also have
a more general regulatory takings claim based on the familiar factors that the Supreme Court identified in Penn Central and some other cases that require consideration of the nature of the use, the economic burden, whether there's a reciprocal advantage being given to the property owner, investment-backed expectations, whether there's some noxious use being eliminated. And we say if you look at those factors, the only possible conclusion is that this law affects a regulatory taking. We compared prices of buildings with large numbers of rent-regulated units to those that are unregulated, and found that even before the 2019 law, there was a 25 to 50% differential, and we alleged, based on some experts that we consulted, that the 2019 law was going to have another 15% differential added to that. So that's a pretty substantial economic burden resulting from this law.
Huge. Well, we only have a couple minutes left, but can you say what issue you think maybe the judges seemed to be most sympathetic on, and maybe what issue you think that you know, if you would win on, it might be that issue, and maybe what they were most skeptical of?
Well, there was a lot of skepticism in the at the panel from their questions. But I do think the entire focus was really on physical takings. There was a little discussion of our regulatory takings claim, and an interesting Judge Calabresi said so what seemed to be some favorable things about Justice Scalia's view in Pinnell, although he emphasized that it was a dissent. So I think physical takings are likely to be the focus. There was a lot of indication, though, that the Second Circuit might be reluctant to move out in front of the Supreme Court, and several of the judges said, you know, maybe this is an issue that's more appropriate for the Supreme Court than for the Second Circuit, given that there were some Second Circuit precedents. So I think those are seem to be the concerns that the panel was balancing.
Well, if the case has to go up to the U.S. Supreme Court, that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. I assume there are other places in the country where similar kinds of laws are causing problems. San Francisco comes to mind. So if the Supreme Court gave more guidance on this issue across the board, that could be helpful beyond New York City as well.
I think that's right. In addition to your terrific amicus briefs, we had 9 other amicus briefs supporting our position, and one of them was filed by associations of property owners in San Francisco and California, pointing to the burdens of their law.
Terrific. Well, the case is Community Housing Improvement Program v. City of New York. The attorney is Andy Pincus and Mayor Brown. Thank you for coming to Administrative Static and telling us about the case.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. This is John Vecchione, and we're going to we just heard from Andy Pincus on a new Supreme Court case from last term that talked about takings, and it moved takings law a little bit more to be more protective of property, because you didn't have to have a full seizure of the property. You could seize the property for a certain amount of time. Case he was referring to, California had required landowners to allow union organizers on their property for a certain amount of time. And that took that property for that amount of time, and it was deemed a taking. So was that a revolution? And I don't think so. But that theory that the new composition of the Supreme Court is going to create a, quote, revolution in the law has gained a little purchase. And I read an interesting article in The Atlantic by Mary Ziegler. And Mary Ziegler is a scholar. She's at Florida State University. She's a Harvard Law alum and clerked at Vermont Supreme Court. And she's a big brain, basically, who writes about the law. And her specialty is the history of abortion. She's written like 3 books on abortion and the law. But and she mentions it in this Atlantic article. And her take is that the justices, the originalist justices, are not concerned about the perception of the court, which on her telling has dropped because, they are deemed as political, which usually in these type of articles means that you're deemed political when you're not doing whatever the progressives want, I think is how you get deemed political. But her argument is not that crude. Her argument is really that there's now a legal culture formed by the Federalist Society, and that certain judges can look for them for validation. I would make the argument, I think that it's that the legal community almost alone amongst the sort of and anybody who has to get a job through a graduate degree has not become a monoculture. And the Federal Society is probably a big part of that, but it hasn't been. Also, it's because there's two sides in every law case, you know, like dun-dun. Law and order, right? There's two sides. There's the prosecution and the defense. So you have to have people engage that way. And if you have everyone thinks the same, then you know everyone ends up being prosecutors or everyone ends up being defense attorneys. But she posits in this article that the court is taking on a bunch of what she'd call controversial cases. And she focuses on abortion, but she also thinks and states that there could be a revolution in administrative law. And that caught my eye because obviously here at New Civil Liberties, we think that the administrative state, unmoored from constitutional constraints and unmoored from statutes even, has taken on a life of its own, and that courts, because of historical reasons, are loath to address that that untethered branch of the government. And so the question is, are her fears and I guess our hopes, are they going to be justified by the Supreme Court? And I'll just read the, since I'm quoting her, since I've looked at this article, I might as well quote her. It says, if the court reverses Roe, holds affirmative action to be unconstitutional, dramatically expands gun rights, and hamstrings the administrative state, and does so quickly, it will damage its own reputation with the broadly defined legal community, but it won't with the Federal Society, basically. I am not so sure that that's going to happen, and I'm not so sure that's true. And the reason I say this is that administrative law changed overnight. Let's say in a switch in time that saved nine, right? 1937, a court that had already been going very pro-administrative law started approving everything Franklin Roosevelt's agencies did. And they didn't stop. They didn't really stop at all. Did outrageous things until the Steele seizure cases in the 1950s. They finally said, huh, maybe there's some places the president and the administrative state can't go. But so what would this revolution, I'll put the other issues aside because it's really not our thing, but where, what would an administrative revolution look like? Well, would requiring juries before you take someone's property, is that a revolution that's going to really look bad in the in the legal community? I don't think so. There's a lot of support for juries on the left and right. I mean, certainly my days as a plaintiff's attorneys, we liked juries. And it didn't matter whether we're left wing or right wing. We think the facts should be decided by juries rather than a guy who's going to have the group think of whatever school you went to. And so I also think, well, did the administrative agencies have to explain their decisions with precision under the APA? I mean, I think the APA itself has a lot of restraints on the administrative state that have simply been blown through by the accumulated precedent. If they start rolling it back, and even if they don't make a constitutional statement and say, well, look, the APA says that we're not supposed to give deference, and they stop giving deference to the agencies because the APA says it.
Sacre bleu. Sorry, I said sacre bleu. That's just my interjection of shock that they might stop giving deference to the agencies. Goodness.
All right, exactly. And what if they just do it and they say, listen, we've got the APA wrong. The Congress said it clearly and they've stated it before. And so we're not going to give deference under the APA. It's not a constitutional issue at all. Would that be a revolution? I don't think that's a revolution. I think the law has been pressing in that area. I think that Congress enacted the APA a certain way, and it would be a reasonable interpretation.
And, well, it would be revolutionary to start implementing the laws that Congress actually passes instead of the ones that that the courts interpret Congress to have passed. That would be different, or that rather the administrative agencies have interpreted Congress to pass. It would be a refreshing return to self-government and democracy.
I think that's right. I think it would be a return, but I think it would be a correction. I don't think it'd be a revolution.
Okay.
I mean, you look at and I brought up the steel seizures case because there had been a Great Depression and World War II, and in such things, the federal government becomes more powerful, and they may overreach. And the court eventually said, maybe they can overreach. I think that here the administrative agencies have so much money, so much power, and they intersect with American life in so many areas that the courts are going to be looking at that. And I Justice Breyer is retiring. I would say that he and a guy like Cass Sunstein, who cares about costs of regulatory implementation, you know, these are not radicals. These are some of the most moderate left progressives you have, but they were seen by some people as being, you know, too restrictive of the administrative state, which,
yes,
you know, you and I can't even conceive of, but there's that criticism. But once again,
standing athwart progressive dreams, I guess so.
But it is not a revolution to move back to the idea that the administrative agencies are there to administer government programs. They're there to do certain things that Congress has told them to do, but they're not there to do everything. They don't have a roving commission to do anything that they want to. And certainly during the COVID crisis, we have seen this idea that whatever power is given to them, they can use it for anything. And it reminds me a little bit, during the Cold War, everything was national security, right? Anytime anyone wanted to do anything, they say, this is vital to national security. And whether it was schools, whatever it was, they would put a national security moniker on it because that was the key drive of that era. Here, they'll say, well, it's COVID, so we have all this power with no change in statutes. And I think the courts have pushed back on that. We saw it in the CDC litigation. We've seen it in the Labor Department getting sort of slapped down. That is not revolutionary. What was revolutionary was the administrative agencies claiming never before exercised power. And if you read the court cases, Mark, I think what you see is they say, you've never done this before. And since you've never done this before, show us where you got this power from Congress and from the normal legal processes in the Constitution beforehand. Well, if they can't show the courts that, and the courts say,
show us your papers.
What?
Telling the administrative agencies, show us your papers.
Exactly. Exactly. Before there's a vax mandate, there has to be a congressional mandate. I think that that's not revolutionary, but I wonder, I don't know, I don't know the professor, but I wonder if she would consider that a revolution. I consider that simply not allowing a revolution, right? If the administrative agencies claim power they've never had, and the courts just say, yeah, you have power you've never been given and you've never had, and we're not going to do anything about it, regardless of the statute. What you've done is you because of how the system works and how Congress works, that you're supposed to have to initiate and get legislation and get consensus and push it all through for change rather than change coming from the top down from the administrative agencies. You've completely turned the Constitution upside down, where Congress has to go around playing whack-a-mole, stopping the administrative agencies. That's not how it's supposed to work. So I don't see a revolution coming. I think that in administrative law, we hopefully would be positive change, but we're not going to turn the Constitution upside down. We'll be back in a little bit.